What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, tremendous Wednesday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Call to Communion. It's a program that's geared mostly for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, but if you're maybe in conversation with someone who is not Catholic, or if you just have a general question, we can sprinkle those in here and there. If you'd like to be part of the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to hear from you. That number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. That email address is ctc@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, sitting in today for Tom Price. Pedro Quiles is our producer. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky. And who is our social media maven? I guess it's, I know it's not Charles. It must be Michael McCall. Let's go with Michael McCall as our social media maven. So if you're watching us on YouTube, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as he is every single day on this program, is who I have just learned is an expecting great-grandfather, Dr. David Anders. How are you?
Jack, I'm all right. How about you?
Terrific, thanks. You're going to be the youngest great-grandfather on the history of in the history of mankind when your two-year-old granddaughter gives birth to this hedgehog she claims she's pregnant with.
Yeah, two-year-old told her grandmother she was pregnant with a baby hedgehog. Yeah, that's right.
Well, at least it's a baby. Yeah. Just when you thought the election couldn't get weirder, right? got an email here from Laura in Wyoming, and she says, I was watching an older program, and a question was asked about why water was added to the wine at presentation of gifts. I always thought this was in remembrance of the blood and water that flowed from his side when opened by the lance.
Yeah, so here's a really interesting feature about Catholic life and tradition. That sometimes we do stuff and then we try to come up with a reason afterwards to explain it. And the rationale for that, I mean, the explanation for that is that there are elements of liturgical tradition that are so ancient that they predate any written source. And so then you'll find church fathers reflecting, hey, why is it we do this way? Referring to a practice that is seemingly of apostolic origins. And then they come up with explanations. And so within the Mass itself, there is an explanation of the divinity of Christ and the humanity of Christ that coexist, of course, in the divine person. And so water, the water and the wine are symbolic of the divine and the human. I think the blood and water flowing from the side of Christ is also very plausibly at the origin of that institution. But the fact of the matter is that the practice itself is very ancient. And Catholics have always allegorized the elements of their own liturgy, particularly when they don't quite understand all of the reasons behind it, right? But those are explanations that could plausibly be given.
And we do, as you mentioned, the text of the liturgy kind of gives us some insight there.
Yeah, exactly. the text states it. But my point is that particular prayer within the liturgy is not as old as the practice itself. The practice of mixing the water in the wine is older than that particular prayer in the liturgy.
You know, it's funny. Father Mitch always likes to say whenever someone brings up the traditional Latin Mass question, because Father Mitch, as most people know, is by ritual in the Maronite rite,
mm-hmm.
the Lebanese Maronite rite.
Right, right.
And so he says, yeah, I don't like that newfangled traditional Latin Mass stuff. I like to stick to the Maronite liturgy.
Right. Which, if you don't know, is in Syriac.
That's right.
Which is the liturgical language closest to the Aramaic that Jesus would have used.
and the actual words of institution are in
Aramaic.
Aramaic.
Right, that's right.
Dominic writes in, would you please describe what this document is and what it does as far as the Reformation, the Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification?
Are you talking about the joint declaration on the doctrine of justification that was issued by the Catholic Church and
yes,
the, and the World Lutheran Federation?
That's actually what's in the subject line. That's not in the body of the email, but that is in the subject line.
Oh, that's only the most misunderstood ecumenical document ever produced in the history of the Church, in my judgment, right? So, first of all, here's how ecumenism works. With ecumenism, that means you're trying to build points of commonality with another religious tradition. Do you, A, go in guns blazing, screaming that the other side is a heretic, or B, go in and say, let's see what we can agree on today, right? Well, if your goal is to build good relations, it would be option B. You don't go in guns blazing, yelling everybody's a heretic, which means that typically ecumenical meetings are oriented to producing common statements that both sides can sign. Like, hey, here's a bunch of stuff we agree on. And there was a meeting, it was in about 89, I think, between the Catholic Church and some Lutheran Federation to compose a joint statement on the doctrine of justification, because justification is historically the area where the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church have their most significant disagreement, on the things that we could agree upon. And that's exactly what they did. They produced a document saying, here are all the things we agree on concerning the doctrine of justification. What does the document explicitly prescind from doing? Listing all the things where we disagree. Right? Now, why did I begin by saying it's the most misunderstood ecumenical document? Because I have heard countless people refer to the document and say, or interpret it as saying, hey, look, the Catholics and the Lutherans no longer disagree on justification. See, they've issued a statement and now they agree on justification. That is a misinterpretation of the document. The Catholics and Lutherans have always agreed on the things they said they agreed upon. Those aren't the substantive differences. The things that we don't agree on didn't make it into the document, but are still dogmatic claims of each of the respective traditions. So it's good to have ecumenical statements, but you have to understand what their purpose is and not misinterpret their significance.
Pick up the phone and give us a call. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. I want to invite you to turn to Mary, the Mother of God, for help bearing witness to the gift of life with the National Life Rosary. It's designed exclusively for EWTN. The unique centerpiece and crucifix represent the reality that all life is sacred and begins at the moment of conception. Help pray for and build a culture of life with the National Life Rosary, available now at EWTN's religious catalog. That's EWTNRC.com. What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? We would love for you to call and give us that reasoning. The number is 833-288-EWTN. It's a free phone call anywhere in the United States and Canada, 833-288-3986. We have an email from John in Bel Air, Maryland, and he says, Dr. Anders, I appreciate your show. Here's my question. Since the physical bodies of Christ and Our Lady were raised up to heaven, can we not assume that there is a physical place, heaven, where they are now? Are the souls of saints at the same physical heaven or in a separate spiritual heaven until their bodies are raised? It's hard to comprehend another physical place outside our physical universe. What do we know about this, if anything?
Not much. Not much is what we know about it, okay? And so I think we are really left here to speculation. Now, here's one thing that we, I think, can know with certainty. If you get in the Starship Enterprise and, you know, travel at light speed beyond the known galaxies, you're not going to bump up against a glass sphere on the other side of which is the realm of God and the holy angels and the saints. And Jack is chuckling over here at the illustration, but that used to be the cosmology. If you look at medieval cosmologies, they will discuss sometimes what was called the Empyrean or the Empyrean heavens, and it was the belief that beyond the fixed stars, with a geocentric cosmology, that there was a point beyond which you would get to the abode of of God, the saints, and the holy angels. And in fact, one of the jobs of the holy angels was to push the spheres around the earth. You know, that was the motive force that would get them moving. And none of that is sacred scripture. None of that is dogmatic tradition of the Catholic Church. This was medieval philosophers who inherited the Ptolemaic and Aristotelian universe, and what they thought of as the scientific worldview at the time, because it was the one that had been produced by Greek philosophers without the benefit of revelation. And then they were trying to do what Catholics have always tried to do, which is to integrate what the best science of the day has to say with what divine revelation has to say. So they didn't get this worldview from Scripture so much, but they tried to figure out how a Christian universe could fit into a Ptolemaic or Aristotelian cosmology. Obviously, that position is false. So what should we hold today as Catholics? Again, Church hasn't said, don't know, God hasn't revealed it, but I'll throw something out for your consideration. The angels are not eternal, all right? But their temporal existence is different from ours, because we have bodies and they don't. Now, we're getting ready to talk about Jesus who has a body, but just hold with me for a second. So what the scholastics said about the angels was that their experience of temporality was something called aveternity or avum, as opposed to our experience of temporality. And if you can imagine a kind of intermediate stage between pure eternity and pure temporality, whatever that would be, that's where the angels dwell. That's their temporal existence. They have a kind of experience of successive moments, but it's not to be marked with physical time the way we do. All right. I imagine that there is something analogous in terms of the modes of existence of matter. That the matter that we possess obeys one set of physical laws. We know that the matter of Christ's resurrected body is different from ours because it can do things like pass through walls. And St. Paul tells us explicitly it's not the same kind of stuff as our matter. And so it obeys a different set of physical laws. Now, one of the things about the matter of Christ's resurrected flesh is that it has the capacity to be present substantially in multiple hosts simultaneously in tabernacles all over the world. Last time I checked, Jack couldn't do that, right? So the doctrine of the real presence suggests that there's something deeply mysterious about the mode of Christ's body and blood, at least with respect to Holy Communion. And that, I think, sort of deepens my analogy to the situation of aveternity. So there's some kind of quasi, if you will, physical existence of Christ's resurrected and ascended body, but it clearly operates according to different physical laws than ours.
You know, I don't just come here to have you point out my shortcomings.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. First up today is Mark in the Republic of Texas, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Mark, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Guys, I'll cut to the chase here real quick, and without going down theological rabbit holes and tangents, I have a really close neighbor and friend who is a very devout Christian evangelical Protestant. And we've had some really good progress on moving away from his Catholic bias and really educating and having a great dialogue. And he said something to me this week that really I have no answer for, and that is, how can I in good faith consider being a Catholic when the war on children is so pervasive and evil when it comes to abortion? And even though the Catholic Church says it's pro-life, the leader of the Catholic Church says you have a choice of two evils, of a lesser evil when you vote. And I had no answer for him. And without getting into death penalty and all the tangential things people say, I think he raises a good point. I mean, we need stronger leadership in this area because there's, what, 2 million abortions a year and 20 people killed by the death penalty, and we've allowed people to equate the two. So without going into, again, theological rabbit holes, would you please help me, Dr. Andrews, with what I can tell this individual?
Absolutely. I think you really have to come at this from a number of different angles. So one of them, the first thing that comes to my mind is, I wonder if your friend would have become a Christian in the first century in Antioch when St. Peter was the bishop of Antioch. Some Protestants may or may not recognize that Peter actually was the bishop of Antioch. I mean, tradition does, but he will know that Peter was at least in Antioch because Paul says he was in the book of Galatians. When Peter was in Antioch, I wonder if your buddy would have become a Christian, because the leader, of course, would have been Peter. And I think by your buddy's criteria, Peter was a fairly weak leader. I mean, when it came to the question of standing up for the rights of Gentile converts in the church in Antioch, Peter was pretty weak-kneed. And it wasn't his first episode of being weak-kneed. So would that have dissuaded him from becoming a Christian? Because St. Peter was not a great leader, was not a strong leader. Interesting, isn't it, that Christ chose this weak-kneed guy to govern the church, right? That's one point of comparison. Now, have all of Peter's successors in the papacy been weak-kneed? Not at all. Would your buddy have liked becoming Catholic more, say, when Pius IX was pope? Maybe not, but for different reasons, right? Point being that the Catholic Church is certainly not limited to one particular office holder at one particular period of history. But we have had popes with as character as wildly different as any two individuals can be. We've had saints, we've had sinners, we've had scoundrels, we've had diplomats, we've had theologians, we've had administrators, we've had incompetents. And the point of the Catholic hierarchy is not to guarantee that we always have the best qualified leadership at any given moment. That's up to providence and the personal gifts and virtues of the office holder. The point of the papacy is to guarantee the integrity of the Catholic faith down for 2,000 years, and it's met its job description doing that. And the real interesting thing is that, you know, it's a job description, and popes can do a good job or a bad job, depending. They will be held accountable to God. There are real consequences for their behavior. Some of them may go to hell. Some of them will be canonized saints. But regardless of whether they do a good or bad job, the church continues to make saints in every era, and that is its fundamental position. I mean, that's its major job. Is the major job of the church to influence political policy? Is that its number one job? Well, I've never met the Protestant who would actually come out and make that claim. Now, many of them may behave that way, but push comes to shove, I mean, evangelical Protestants typically think the job of the church is to save souls. And Catholics do too, although we have a different conception about how that happens. It doesn't seem to me at all that Jesus made his principal concern influencing Roman imperial policy. On the contrary, Christ said, you know, render to Caesar what is Caesar and to God what is God's. And he knew darn well that Caesar's policy was not God's at all. And he never said a word against it, not at least in the recorded scriptures that we have. I don't see Paul wringing his hands because Nero wants to marry his horse or something, right? I mean, there were all kinds of horrible things in the political realm, and the apostles in the New Testament basically just seem to ignore them in the interest of the salvation of souls. And they think that the church is the vehicle for the transformation of individuals in society, and they're not so much worried about public policy. It's the Catholic Church, actually, that begins this Christian fascination with the transformation of public institutions. And so, you know, the doctrine of social justice that is a Catholic doctrine, emerges out of Catholic theological concern. And it really wasn't until, about the 1980s, that evangelical Protestants suddenly became politically active. And in the 1940s, Carl F. H. Henry wrote a famous book called The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism, criticizing his conservative Protestant confreres in the United States in the 19th and early 20th century for their political disengagement. And by and large, evangelicals were largely disengaged from political action for most of the 20th century. And in fact, when Roe v. Wade was first issued by the Supreme Court, the Southern Baptist Convention issued a document praising the court for its decision that facilitated, upheld, and respected the principle of the separation of church and state. And the Catholic Church was the institution in the United States that was out advocating against abortion and against Roe v. Wade. Evangelicals didn't jump on the bandwagon until about 1980 when Francis Schaeffer and C. Everett Koop and Ronald Reagan began pushing that agenda, and then Operation Rescue and the Moral Majority and, you know, those other institutions, James Dobson and folks on the family began to get involved. But the Catholics really beat them to the punch on that by a long stretch. You remember John Courtney Murray's book, We Hold These Truths, about the American proposition. Of course, you know, Murray was a Catholic public theologian operating in the 50s and the 60s when Southern Baptists were still happy for the separation of church and state. So, I think a little historical perspective would be helpful. In terms of the present Pope's position, I don't claim to understand the mind of the Pope. I do think that, you know, when they do make interventions on public policy, they're operating out of their own prudential judgment, which is not guaranteed to be infallible by any stretch of the imagination. It is the fact that a particular sitting pontiff might have a different political ideology from your friend. Is his criteria to only pick churches where the leadership holds his political ideology? Is that the right criterion? I mean, these are all lines of approach that you might consider taking.
Thanks, Mark. We appreciate the phone call. Another Mark is watching us on YouTube, and he writes in, "Doctor, I note your description of quote-unquote conquest as normative historical human behavior. The 16th century Spanish priest Bartolome de las Casas documented the genocidal atrocities by Columbus and his crew upon the Taino people, so Columbus no longer shines as brightly in the Caribbean. When all nations are to be judged, where should the church stand on Columbus?"
Here's what I can't possibly do, all right? I cannot issue God's verdict from the point of view of the general judgment at the end of time. Christ said, "Judge not lest you be judged." I mean, I'm not going to do that. I'm clearly not going to countenance, I'm not going to validate or approve the conquest of the Americas and the slaughter of indigenous peoples. I'm certainly not going to do that. I'm not going to excuse the gross violations of human rights that European colonialists have inflicted on indigenous peoples around the world. I'm not going to excuse that. I will, however, contextualize it. And as you mentioned in your email, it seems to me the rite of conquest and the reality of conquest is the perennial international law that governed the lives and the interactions of peoples from time immemorial, and that this is only challenged in the modern era on Christian principles that Catholic theologians articulated. And so the fact that we can sit here in the 21st century and pass judgment on the behavior of Catholics of 500 years ago is thanks to certain principles of Catholic political and moral theology triumphing over other forms of Catholic behavior with the benefit of hindsight and a little bit more prudent judgment. It was the conquest of the Americas and the exploitation of the Indians that prompted Catholic theologians in Salamanca to invent the doctrine of human rights so they could oppose such conquests. I don't see that coming out of other imperial regimes from other religious traditions.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. We want to hear from you at 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. EWTN. That's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. We head next to the great state of Georgia. Marie is watching us on YouTube today. Marie, you are on with Dr. David Anders. Hi, Marie. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
Oh, you're okay. Go right ahead.
This was a bleep for me. I'm so sorry.
Go right ahead.
I just have a question about how to interact with the Catholic faith. As someone who was raised Catholic, fallen away a little bit, but only finds that truth, beauty, and goodness in Catholicism, how to interact with that when the mankind portion of Catholicism is so frustrating. It just makes it difficult for me to attend Mass or surround myself with fellow Catholics because of all the different ways people who call themselves Catholic act that really does not fit the Catholic description.
Yeah, thanks. Well, first of all, I'd like to tell you that I'm profoundly sympathetic to your point of view because it's one that I share. Maybe with one caveat, maybe with one distinction, that when I look around with disgust at the poor behavior of Catholics, that very often I'm looking at myself as well as the guy next to me in the pew, or at least I hope I am, because I'm quite certain that my poor behavior has probably put somebody off from the Catholic faith before, and I know that sometimes I've looked at my own behavior and I've been put off by myself, you know, and thought, you know, gosh, why do I belong to that guy's religion, you know? So I really do appreciate the perspective that you have. And, you know, my point of view on it as a Catholic and as a convert to the Catholic Church is that, you know, what the Catholic Church actually promises is not that all of its members will be holy and righteous and good. What it promises is that it provides the resources that can help all of its members become holy, righteous, and good should they choose to cooperate. But it doesn't hold your feet to the fire and make you cooperate. I mean, it's kind of like taking somebody and dropping them off in the parking lot of the gym and saying, there's everything you need in there to get in shape. And, you know, I've been going to the gym my entire life. And, you know, if you spend a lot of time, you spend several years in the same gym, you go the same time every day, what you typically find out is the same out of shape, overweight, fat people on the same cardio machines every day, you know, for 5 years running. And you're like, you know, that guy looked exactly like that 5 years ago. Like, I don't think he's using this equipment the right way, or he's doing something in the kitchen the wrong when he gets done, you know? He's really not making progress. Maybe I'll stop going to the gym, right? But then you go around the corner to the free weight room and you see some, you know, buff guy who's got, you know, biceps the size of fire hydrants, and you're like, okay, so it works for somebody. And I kind of think we're in the same situation with virtue and holiness, that, you know, the existence of the saints, you know, they're like the Mr. Universe of the Catholic faith. You know, they are proof that charity and virtue are possible, not only possible, but imminently possible and beautifully possible within the orbit of the Catholic faith, that through the practice of their faith, there are individuals who've come to surpassing holiness and virtue and charity. And what we're meant to do is to model ourselves on those exemplars. And, you know, we have this thing called the sacrament of confession, wherein I go in and, among other things, I can compare where I am today to, you know, to wherever those exemplars are and where I think I ought to be given my state of life, and then use all the tools available to me. Now, you mentioned the presence of truth, goodness, and beauty in the Catholic faith. And, yeah, I feel the same way. And that's what attracted me as well to the Catholic Church. I said, I want to get me some of that truth, goodness, and beauty. And what I have found in my own life, personally, in pursuit of holiness and virtue, is that the most important thing, probably, has been to articulate those principles, what does holiness and virtue look like, and the presence of exemplars. And not only the canonized saints, but Catholics that I have known and Christians that I've known who have really, you know, known personally, that have lived or continue to live exemplary lives, and particularly those that have cared about me as an individual. And they're few and far between. You know, in any decade, I might only have one. But that's enough for me, you know, to have one or two people in my life that are just really outstanding. And I know they're there for me and they've been there for others. That's kind of enough to go on. And then here's where all the work gets done, at least in me. You know, I used to think that to grow in holiness or virtue, what I had to do was I need to exert just tons of effort. I needed to kind of grit my teeth and you know, clench my fists and I think I can kind of exertion. And what I've kind of revised that after being Catholic for 20 years. And I think what's been much more helpful is my own continuing record of abysmal failure. And, you know, was it Edison who found out, what did he find, 10,000 ways not to make a light bulb, you know? Every failure was marking something else off the list. And, you know, there's a whole spirituality in the church. It's very ancient. It goes back, you know, pretty much to the 4th century or maybe even earlier, called apophaticism, or the negative way in the Latin tradition. And it's the way of continually refining your conception of God to purify it of corruption. And it's keep finding more and more ways not to make a light bulb and marking them off. And when you mark them all off, you kind of find that the self drops away out of that. You know, like all of the things that you invested yourself in, all of the artificialities, all of the roles, all the masks that you put on, all of the things that you thought were going to give you significance, that you snuck in the back door of your Catholic conversion, then you didn't recognize it. All the little petty ambitions and jealousies and pride and insecurities that you had that you managed to theologize and cover up with so many good arguments. Those just get stripped away one by one by one through the process generally of banging your head against the brick wall of reality and suffering and failure. And if you're open, if you're docile to see that, right? And it's really unnecessary. All the saints talk about this process. It's called the purgative way. And if you're open to that, if you're docile and teachable, and you let the pain of reality sort of eat away like acid at all of those artificialities in your personality, you know, you're left as this sort of bare, naked something standing alone before God. And you go, I'm nothing. I've got nothing. I'm like, I have everything. The psalmist in Psalm 88 says, Lord, you know, all my friends and companions have been taken away from me, and my one companion is darkness. John of the Cross wrote a whole book about it called The Dark Night of the Soul, where every consolation has been removed and you're standing there in utter blackness of spirit. And God finally says, okay, now we're getting somewhere. Now I can do something, right? That's a necessary part of growth and holiness, which abandoning all of my conceptions. And then finally, the church, when you let it, and its saints, has these practices that can build you back up again. You know, they say you go to Marine boot camp, they break you down so they can build you back up. Catholic Church works the same way. Baptism is the reality and the figure of that, dying to self, to the world, to the old man with Christ so you can be born again. This is a hard process. It's a miraculous process. It's a supernatural process. It happens in its fullness to the canonized saints. Many of us will be stuck our whole lives in the purgative way. I think that's the perspective you bring.
God bless you, Marie. Hope that helps you with a little bit of encouragement today. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Nate is in Omaha, Nebraska. He's listening to us today on Spirit Catholic Radio. Nate, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Hello. I have a question today about the philosophy of phalangism. Just for context, it is the ideology that was created in response, I guess, to Germany's nationalist socialism. And I was wondering if the church holds it as heresy to agree with it.
Yeah, thanks. So what little I know of phalangism is it was a Spanish form of Catholic integralism or authoritarianism that I think tell me if I'm getting this right or if I'm getting it wrong, that was, you know, really associated with the idea of Catholicism as the sort of the national identity of Spain and had a very authoritarian top-down view of imposing the church on Spanish culture. And, you know, we can almost sort of hearken back to the Ferdinand and Isabella good old days of the Spanish Inquisition, right? I mean, it's sort of the specter that haunts in the background there. And the church's position is that's not the right way to go. That's not the right way to go. And, you know, the church has a doctrine of conscience and a doctrine of faith that holds that by its nature, faith can't be coerced. You know, what faith is the free decision to yield oneself to what God has revealed into relationship with God, and it can't be compelled. It's like Shakespeare had a sonnet where he says, "How can I hold thee but by thy granting?" Imagine trying to marry a woman and saying, "Well, I'd like to marry you, and so I command that you love me." It's an oxymoron. Like, as soon as you issue that command, you guarantee the impossibility of its fulfillment. As soon as you demand love from another human being, it becomes impossible for them to love you, because love is a freely self-gift and a kind of mutually reciprocal, accelerating self-disclosure. And as soon as it becomes compulsive, then it stops being love, right? And faith is like that. Like, faith is this total gift of self to God and everything he's revealed. The minute you try to compel it at the, you know, price of a sword, then it starts being something other than faith. Now, you know, that being said, the church does think that there are objective moral goods, and the public worship of God is one of them, and that societies that are well-ordered will integrate those objective moral goods. And since the church thinks that the Catholic Church is objectively true, then, you know, the ideal society should be one in which the Catholic faith can be freely practiced, and one ideally in which everybody will ultimately want to become Catholic because it's good and true and beautiful and they're attracted to it. But it can't be compelled. Now, the fact that previous centuries of Catholics have tried to do just that, notwithstanding, and I think the witness of history has shown that practice magnificently backfired on the church, and probably no place more conspicuously than 1789 in revolutionary France, where the revolutionists said, "Oh yeah, well, we'll do you one better, Catholic Church," and tried to do the opposite and compel atheism, at the cost of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives. And that was copied, of course, by the Bolsheviks in 1917, and by tyrannical regimes around the world ever since.
God bless you, Nate. We appreciate the phone call today. Still one open line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Another great podcast at EWTN's Podcast Central is Restless. It's for zany Catholic young adults seeking God in the midst of this crazy mixed-up world. They discuss life, relationships, work, fun, and everything else in our world through the lens of our Catholic faith. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world at EWTN's Podcast Central. Just visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today. Next up is Vivian in Kansas City, Missouri, listening on the EWTN app today. Vivian, thanks for holding. You're on with Dr. Anders.
Hi, Dr. Anders. This is Vivian. And I appreciate you taking my call. My question is, how is the easiest, simplest way for me to help my Protestant friends understand that the Eucharist is truly the body and blood of Christ? Where they, when I tell them that, they say, "Well, we do that at our church. We believe that Jesus." And then I'm like, but you don't have the priesthood. You know, you have to have the priesthood. And they don't get it. They don't understand.
Yeah, sure. I'm with you. So if I might, I think I wouldn't put the emphasis where you're putting it in dialogue with Protestants about the Catholic and the Protestant Eucharist. I'd put it elsewhere. I would put it where the Reformers put it. Because, see, when Martin Luther left the Catholic Church, Luther firmly believed in the doctrine of the real presence. And he, of course, was a validly ordained Catholic priest, so Luther could validly consecrate the Eucharist, even when he was in schism, even after he'd been excommunicated, he would have had the power to consecrate the Eucharist. That wasn't the real point of difference. The real point of difference wasn't the doctrine of the real presence, and at least in Luther's case, it wasn't even the actuality of the real presence. It was the doctrine of sacrifice. And Luther absolutely was willing to kill or die for the doctrine of the real presence, but he adamantly rejected as an abomination and a sacrilege the Catholic doctrine that the Eucharist is a sacrifice. And he said, it's no sacrifice. and all of Protestantism, with very few exceptions, has followed Luther in rejecting the doctrine that the Mass is a true sacrifice. On the grounds, Luther makes this claim explicitly. He says, as a sacrifice, the Mass is a work. It's something you do for God. You offer it to Him, you know, to merit salvation. And he says, away with works. You know, it's faith alone. And all of Protestantism followed him in that. And that difference remains, and it's stark, and it's the most important one, that Catholics continue to teach and believe and confess. Remember when the priest says at the Mass, he says, pray, my brethren, that my sacrifice and yours may be acceptable. The Mass is something we do that we offer to God. And it is in this specifically that the Eucharist becomes for us the source and summit of our salvation. It's not just in the fact of the real presence or Holy Communion. It is the Eucharistic sacrifice, the Second Vatican Council taught, that makes it the source and summit, because it's there that our redemption is worked out. It's there that we ritually reenact, we memorialize the death of Christ, which death we must imitate if we would be saved. Christ says, if you want to be my followers, take up your cross and follow me. Paul says, offering your bodies is your spiritual act of worship. And for a Protestant, more and more, they understand worship as a passive and receptive thing, where either, you know, music, emotion, a message is transmitted to them to make them feel better or feel different or edify them or something. And Catholics understand that edification and feeling good is all well and good, but it's in the interest of self-giving, of offering, of sacrifice. And I think that if you lead with, you know, the Eucharist is a sacrifice and something that we offer to God to merit salvation, that you'll very quickly be able to get them to admit, oh, yeah, we don't believe that.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Julie's a first-time caller in the great state of Nebraska in Omaha, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Julie, thanks for holding. You're on with Dr. Anders.
Hi, Dr. Anders. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. How about you?
Good, thank you. I true confession here, I am actually Catholic, but I work with the OCI A-team at my church. And last night, an acquirer asked a question that was kind of baffling. And after we tried to address it, we just weren't getting anywhere with her understanding. And I just thought, I need some better resources. So I'm calling you to see if you can help me. And here's the question. She's decided that, as she's very much into digital media, that the earth is flat, and she's really believing this, and tried everything. I said, who is they? They said this, and they said that. I said, who is they? Well, it's people on TikTok. It's researchers. It's pilots. It's this. It's that. And I just thought, and nothing I said was making a difference. Nothing anybody else in the room said made a difference. And so I thought, maybe you might have something for me to say to her about this flat land, you know, flat earth, flat whatever, that you know, kind of goes against what the church teaches about natural science.
I would say so. Okay, so your friend or your inquirer is a conspiracy theorist, and the logic of the conspiracy theory is that it has wide explanatory scope. Conspiracy theories purport to explain everything or massive tons of phenomena. It has wide explanatory scope, but it's very thin on corroboration. And it usually hangs on one narrow thesis that's basically taken on faith. And the thesis is the idea that the world system is conspiring to hide the truth on this one particular issue. And so then with that conviction, the way the conspiracy theorist goes about doing their own research is a massive, massive case study in what cognitive scientists called confirmation bias, right? Only looking for arguments, very spurious arguments, I might add. They're hardly worthy of the name argument, that confirm the sort of paranoid view of the universe, you know, that the world is conspiring to hide the truth from me. And then I myself am one of the few enlightened ones who's in the know. And the appeal of the conspiracy theory is not scientific at all. It's not rational. It's emotional. And it's typically people who are disaffected individuals who feel alienated from that world system. And by holding the conspiracy theory, they become one of the Illuminati, one of the few, one of the elect, one of the people in the know, and that makes them feel special. The phenomenon of claiming to have been abducted by aliens works very much the same way. All these conspiracy theories do. For a really good primer on the psychology of those who are involved in conspiracy theories, in particular the alien cult, but it's analogous, there's a book called Abducted by Susan Clancy, who was a Harvard-trained psychiatrist who really made her name studying the phenomenon of false memories, people who claim to have had experiences and to generally believe that they had them, that are utterly fictitious, right? So that's a little something on the background of there, how these things function. You know, another resource would be to dig more deeply into the literature on cognitive bias. And the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Tversky and I got to look the other guy's name up too, cognitive famous psychologists and cognitive scientists that deal with, sort of wrote the book on cognitive bias and confirmation bias being the most prominent one. In terms of, you know, Catholic resources, when it comes to, did you get the name?
Daniel Kahneman.
That's it, Kahneman. Kahneman and Tversky. When it comes to Catholic sources, you know, the Church has always taught that faith and reason. Oh, I know. No, before I get to faith and reason, St. Thomas in the Summa Theologica, when he discusses the virtue of prudence, you know, how do you make good decisions? He breaks prudence down into subsidiary virtues. You know, what are the character traits that you have to have in order to be a prudent person? And one of the most prominent is the virtue of docility, teachableness, that you are open to evidence. And that really becomes the hallmark of rationality. I mean, it doesn't make you rational that you can concoct an elaborate theory. Every conspiracy theorist has a very elaborate theory, but they're not rational. The reason they're not rational is that when they're presented with contrary evidence, they automatically seek to dismiss it or explain it away. They're only open to information that would seem to confirm their bias. Whereas a prudent or a rational person is somebody who is very open to being contradicted. So you may know that in the philosophy of science, one of the major positions in philosophy of science is called verificationism, and it's associated with the name of Karl Popper. And Popper's position was scientific rationality works by the principle of you subject the theory to verification and to defeaters, and you try to defeat the theory. You try to come up with information that would defeat the theory, and the best scientific theory is never proven. It's just the last one standing after everybody else has been taken down, right? And it still remains probably the sort of one of the dominant ways in which scientists go about doing their work practically. Somebody has a hypothesis, and then you try to shoot it down, and you come up with the null hypothesis, and you do statistical testing and all of the rest of it, right? Conspiracy theories obviously are not open to that kind of verification. They are not looking for ways to falsify their own thesis and strengthen it accordingly. When it comes to the Church's teaching on faith and reason specifically, again, St. Thomas doesn't presume dogmatically that he necessarily has the only right cosmology. Rather, he looks at all the best science of his day, which at that time would have been different Hellenistic theories about the order of the heavens, and then seeks to answer the question, how might any one of these be reconcilable with the Catholic faith? On the principle that whichever one of them happens to be true, well, then that's the one we got to figure out how to fit with Holy Scripture. John Paul II's encyclical Fides et Ratio, you know, be an example of a modern pope who deals with these issues. Catechism of the Catholic Church on faith and reason. First Vatican Council on faith and reason. And then, you know, I'd say the living practice of just reams of contemporary Catholic scientists. One that's a frequent guest on EWTN would be Anthony Rizzi, theoretical physicist, right, you know, who his book, The Science Before Science, So, you know, I mean, we could go on this all day because, I mean, the mountain of evidence against the flat earth position is, well, monumentous.
Don't think I didn't get the message, by the way, with the fat guy on the cardio equipment earlier. On behalf of our host, Dr. David Anders, our producer, Pedro Quiles, our call screener, Matt Kubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Rich Jesse, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in. Sitting in today for Tom Price. He'll be back tomorrow when we ask that same question, what's stopping you from becoming Catholic, on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders.